Say the name, Thelonious Monk, and expect to hear some of the most original and challenging music written in the 20th century. Monk's individual sense of rhythm, harmony, and melody are hallmarks of his musical genius. His signature theme, epistrophe, is a good example. The dictionary says epistrophe is the act of turning round and round. It suits Monk to a T. His works turned the tables on modern music conventions. And on the bandstand, he was fond of spinning in circles, dancing when directing musicians in his compositions. When asked about his spirited band leading, Monk once said, "I get tired of sitting at the piano. I can dig the rhythm better."
Monk dancing was almost as great as his writing or his playing. I mean, that gave me the spirit. When Monk would get up and dance, hey, brother, that's it. It's over. Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles. For the next hour, pianist and composer Thelonious Monk, some of the people who knew him best, and his lasting influence on modern music. Pianist Chick Corea.
Monk, throughout his life, then developed a legacy of music. I mean, he's sort of like the Mozart of jazz. He wrote his own music for his own bands, where he was the main performer, and the songs themselves are now this incredible body of music which I and so many others draw on as great compositions, you know.
Record producer Oren Keep News.
The most difficult thing about communicating with Monk, it was a problem that musicians had right along with me in a working or a record date situation, is that this was incredibly difficult music, and he was a man who I believe sincerely did not understand that it was difficult music.
Composer Anthony Davis.
Well, I think he's had a profound impact. I think that musicians today are rediscovering him. I mean, every month you must see some Monk tribute record or a Monk composition played by a younger artist.
He was born Thelonious Sphere Monk, October 10th, 1917, in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Named after his father, Thelonious was the youngest of three children. He grew up an obedient son and a bright student whose passions for math and science were matched only by his love for music. Jazz drummer T.S. Monk is the son of the legendary composer and musician.
Thelonious was an unusual guy from the time he was 3 years old. I mean, we're talking about a guy who, you know, the piano teacher was giving lessons to his sister when he was about 2 years old, and the piano teacher came to his mother and said, you know, your daughter's a lovely girl, and she likes the piano a lot too, but I think if you only have X amount of dollars to spend on lessons, you need to give the little guy the lessons because I think he has a talent for the piano.
Started to take on trumpet, but I didn't.
And how come you started playing piano?
In 1921, Monk's parents, Barbara and Thelonious Sr., moved the family from North Carolina to San Juan Hill, New York City's first and largest African-American community. Young Thelonious was 3 years old when the family settled there. If you walk to Monk's old neighborhood, you'll find a cul-de-sac called Thelonious Sphere Monk Circle. The great stride pianist James P. Johnson, Willie the Lion Smith, Fats Waller, and Duke Ellington all played within earshot of Monk's home. The stride style was the order of the day in the 20s and 30s. Duke Ellington's music was deeply rooted in the stride tradition. Duke was among Monk's all-time keyboard heroes, and here's Duke with Solitude. Stride is a demanding piano style. In its day, it was the music of competing pianists in saloons and other night spots. The left hand sets a bass line moving or striding up and down the keyboard in a propulsive, danceable rhythm, while the right hand dazzles the ear with melody and improvisation. The music of the Black Church had an effect on Monk. He was baptized in the music of Christian tent revivals and toured with at least one such group at the early age of 13. But Monk was immersed in the stride tradition as well. His ideas about space, syncopation, what many thought were wrong notes, set him apart from the masters he so admired. We can hear the difference in this 1953 version of Solitude, Monk's tribute to his idol, Duke Ellington.
In many ways, Monk was an abstracted stride piano player.
Writer and cultural critic Stanley Crouch.
I think that we can see very early on in Monk's own recordings, Thelonious, in fact, his homage to stride piano, and his kind of sending up of it as well, because it's a very humorous homage, you know. He's bowing to the grandeur of the style. And he's also playing the style in a way that makes it kind of funny. But it's appreciative humor. Most of Monk's humor is appreciative. At least when he's dealing with jazz elements, when he's making fun of some pop song or something, there may be something else going on in his mind.
This version of Tea for Two shows Monk's wry sense of humor. Monk made no distinction between humor and seriousness in his musical statements. It was all music to him.
Critics easily dismissed and ridiculed Monk because he seemed aloof to some and could go for days without speaking to another human being. Monk was also criticized in the press for looking different. He dressed unusually, wore strange hats, eyeglasses, and top coats indoors. But despite the bad press, Monk's compositions have stood the test of time. We're listening to a 1952 Monk recording for Alfred Lyon's Blue Note label. Thelonious Monk leads Max Roach on drums, Nelson Boyd on bass. The horn section includes Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Lucky Thompson on tenor, and Kenny Dorham on trumpet. Here's Skippy.
I think Monk's contribution to the music is that he brought a great thoroughness and precision not only to his playing but to his composing.
Stanley Crouch.
He was very, very strong in thematic improvising too. That is, taking a little motif, a little theme or sub theme, and really developing it, not just running through the chord changes, as it were, but taking a piece of the music and really turning it this way and turning it that and building off of it. And so I guess you could say that he's probably been the biggest influence on this music in thorough musical terms since Charlie Parker, probably.
This music that we call jazz now is very democratic, and I say that because it's collectively created. Everybody has a role to play and everybody has an opportunity to contribute.
When he first met Thelonious Monk in the early 1940s, jazz drummer Max Roach was 17. Back then, in clubs like Mitten's Playhouse in Harlem, experiments with rhythm, harmony, and melody were the order of the day.
When you say modern music, I think of Fats Waller, and I think of Chick Webb, and I think of Kenny Clarke, and of course I think of Thelonious Monk. The music of the 20th century really comes out of those great minds and the earlier people too, that we could kind of throw them on the trash, but if it hadn't been for Fats Waller and Duke Ellington and James P. Johnson, there would be no Thelonious Monk.
The innovators of the 1940s brought new harmonies and dynamic rhythms to jazz music. The name for the new music was bebop. Drummer Roy Haynes, who later played with Monk, was a new student at Mitten's Playhouse, where Monk was one of the tenured professors and a house pianist.
The musicians would have free food and all of that. You get free biscuits and whatever they had on the menu. If I remember correctly, they probably started around 9:30, 10 o'clock, and they went till 4 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes you would still hang around after that, you know, and chat and about this and that and eat. You know, and just enjoy the atmosphere.
In May 1941, several amateur recordings were made at Minton's. This one features a band led by guitarist Charlie Christian and drummer Kenny Clark. Here soloing on the big band favorite Topsy is Thelonious Monk. Bassist Al McKibben played in bands with Monk off and on for 30 years. McKibben first collaborated with Monk during the mid-1940s in an important band led by tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins. McKibben says audiences took to Monk's new musical ideas.
At that time, I don't care how extreme or different some of Monk's things were that we played, people understood and appreciated it. We played for the general public, not just for musicians. All kinds of people came in.
As he was exploring new musical territory at Minton's, Monk had to struggle with a reputation for weird behavior. His musician friends Mary Lou Williams and Coleman Hawkins defended Monk's integrity by pointing to his musical genius. Hawkins is widely quoted as telling his fellow musicians, "Monk is the one." Those who knew and respected Monk found ways to accept him on his own terms. Al McKibben.
Monk used to come to my house. We weren't even working together. He'd come to my apartment. He'd come in, he'd sit down at the table, you know. We'd exchange pleasantries for a minute. And he'd just sit there, you know. And then I'd say, "Well, come on, join us for dinner, Monk." He says, "Well, maybe." Sometimes he would. And then after dinner, we would talk some more. And I said, "Well, man, you know, I'm getting tired, man. I'm going to sleep now." You know, he said, "Okay." So he'd just sit there, and we'd go to bed. We get up the next day, he's still sitting there. He might stay 2 days, just sitting there. I don't know if he was escaping something or if he was concentrating on something. I have no idea. I'd never asked him because I didn't care. He was all right with me. So fine, if he felt secure sitting in my house for 2 or 3 days, fine. He wasn't there using dope and that kind of thing, so that, you know, we were respectable with my wife and my little child there. So if he wanted to sit there and contemplate or whatever he was doing, fine. It was okay with me.
When Blue Note Records dubbed him the High Priest of Bop, it was an effort to sell his unusual character to the public. It became impossible for even the most sympathetic observer to separate Monk the creative musician from Monk the eccentric, T.S. Monk.
The unusual behavior that I speak of when I was a youngster was, in fact, Thelonious. So he was an unusual personality from day one. He was an A student all through elementary and high school. He was an honor roll student. But he was never one that was going to be on the beaten path. So when you begin to talk about how those emotional problems might have manifest themselves in terms of his personality traits or his behavioral traits, it becomes a very, very gray area because we're talking about a genius. Einstein was not a normal, quote, normal person. You know, he did not speak like normal people speak. His thoughts were not the same thoughts that we have. He was thinking on another level. So on the one hand, you can say, well, the behavior was unusual. But on the other hand, might it not be that the behavior is normal for individuals of that intelligence? You know what I mean?
Here's Monk playing Crisscross with Milt Jackson on the vibraphone. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to a tribute to Thelonious Monk on Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio. Monk's inventions in harmony, keyboard effects, and sounds not only made the piano an important instrument in the bop and post-bebop revolutions, but also revealed new approaches to music. Drummer and innovator, Max Roach.
I know Monk was always talking about slurring on the piano, and he did it with minor seconds, you know. He was, you know, some way, and it would sound like a slur, like a voice, you know, that kind of, like a slur. And he was reaching for things like that when you listen carefully to some of the things he's doing. And,
thank you.
As Thelonious Monk's body of work grew in the 1950s, he recorded mostly for the Riverside label. It was music that was impossible to ignore. Produced Thelonious Monk at Riverside for 6.5 years.
The fact that we did so many different things, different combinations of people with him, different formats, different size groups, I think contributes to the fact that, yeah, I will. I'm very proud of just about everything that I did with Monk, and I would like to think that it was among his most important work.
Writer Stanley Crouch.
His techniques, the way he fingered the piano, a lot of it was based on the fact that he really understood that the piano was a percussive instrument that could be approached with the same variety of percussive attacks that, say, a drummer gets, who uses different pressures with his sticks, who uses brushes, who uses mallets, who uses even, say, his hands on the drum heads themselves. And so as a piano player, Monk was often capable of getting these very unusual and wide-ranging tonal colors from his instrument.
Thelonious Monk in the early 1960s, talking with writer Val Wilmer.
You had a classical background, didn't you? Classical training.
Yeah, I studied piano a little bit.
Mm. Did they teach you to put your hand, to hold your hands like that? When you...
That's the way they teach, that's where you hold your hands.
But you've done it, you seem to...
I hold them anyway, I feel like holding them.
Pianist Jerry Allen is one of today's younger jazz artists whose careers have bloomed since Monk. Growing up in Detroit, the birthplace of many jazz pianists, Allen's first encounters with Monk's music came from her teacher, Roy Brooks, who wrote a piece that borrowed freely from Monk's chords and phrasings. We asked Jerry Allen to play one of her favorite Monk tunes.
I learned about introspection through a musician named Donald Walden, and he had an orchestra that included violins and big band. We would have large performances that had tap dancers, vocalists, and in the old way that you used to hear and see a lot of different art forms within the context of one performance. And this was one of the compositions that Donald had the orchestra playing. And I just remember the difficulty of it initially. Over the years, I've played it from medium slow to Like today, I'm going to do it a lot brighter. It's hard, but it's so much fun, you know? It's fun to play. It's like I have a lot of fun playing Bach, particularly the preludes and the fugues, because it's challenging, technically, and it's fun. It was written in a way that makes it fun to play, and that's what this is, too. This is very technically, for me, it's very challenging. But there's a lot of joy in the sound that the composition is producing. Just the process of playing through it, it's always surprise, and there's a lot of fun in that.
Pianist Jerry Allen. Introspection was written and recorded while Monk was signed to Blue Note Records in the early 1950s. Overall, the 50s were Monk's most prolific years as a composer and recording artist. Sadly, at this richly productive time, he lost the right to perform in his beloved hometown, New York City. The story goes that pianist Bud Powell and Monk were in a car. They were pulled over by the police for narcotics possession. The contraband was supposedly Bud Powell's, but Monk wasn't known for turning in friends. As a result, Monk served a 60-day jail sentence. When he was released, the police took Monk's cabaret license, which meant he couldn't play in New York clubs. T.S. Monk.
I don't remember him being frustrated because, I mean, I can tell you that during those years, my father was poor as a church mouse. I mean, he was scraping, but he or my mother never allowed us to see the hard times. But I do remember a period where Dad was home a lot. He was home and he was writing music a lot. You know, and Mom was out working. My mother was a hairdresser, and she was a seamstress, and I think she did some restaurant waitressing, and she even lost her finger in a pressing out 80-millimeter shells for the U.S. Army during the Second World War. So she did many, many, many odd jobs while my father was working. But you have to understand that Nellie met Thelonious first when she was about 12 years old, and they didn't even see each other formally until she was about 18. But she had absolute undying faith in this man's ability not only to create but to earn a living.
That's Monk's composition, Panonica. Monk wrote the piece after the Baroness Panonica de Koenigswarter, a long-standing patron, and some say a groupie, of American jazz musicians. Years after his arrest and incarceration, the Baroness helped Monk win back the right to play in New York again. In 1956 and 57, two events helped Monk's career. First was the recording of Brilliant Corners. Brilliant Corners is considered some of the most difficult and demanding music ever written for ensemble by Monk. It features bassist Oscar Pettiford, Sonny Rollins on tenor sax, the late Ernie Henry on alto, and Max Roach on drums and timpani.
You know, we used to get paid union scale, which is the minimum. And you'd finish a date, maybe, they'd insist, in a couple of days, at most 6 hours. Well, you know, so the musicians never made any money, really, you know. And Monk appreciated the fact that he had Oscar Pettiford and Sonny Rollins and Ernie Henry and us with him on his date. So he insisted that we learn that music, which was really unique and unusual. And when you listen to the record, of course, you hear that. By ear, which meant the first day we were in the studio, we got a little bit of the music. The second day, we learned a little bit more of it by ear. Finally, the third day, and he said, I got all you great musicians in my studio, and you still can't play my music. Well, so it took us about 5 days to do to finish the date. And on the fifth day, he pulled out the music. We had gotten it now, but it was a good lesson in a lot of things for us as far as the music is for the ear, not for the eye. And we had a chance to really get to live and get into that music at that time only because of the fact that we learned it by ear. But one of the reasons that I always thought that Monk gave us 5 days in the recording studio was that we could make more money. Because he did things like that. He never talked about it. And if you mentioned it to him, he would just give you that sly look of his that would come from his eye, and maybe he'd just, maybe grunt or turn around and go someplace else.
In 1957, a second event opened new doors to Monk. He played a now famous engagement with John Coltrane at the Five Spot Cafe, a dank, cramped space in the Bowery. At the time, Coltrane was a still relatively unknown tenor saxophonist. It was in Monk's group, in between stints with Miles Davis, that John Coltrane began to develop the playing style that would later be called Sheets of Sound. Monk's five-spot band regularly included Shadow Wilson on drums and Wilbur Ware on bass. Because of recording contracts, Monk and Coltrane never officially recorded together at the five-spot live. Coltrane's wife, Naima, did. She made a tape of Monk and Train on a night when Roy Haynes was the drummer.
Da-da-la-da, da-da-la-da. That's Christopher. Da-da-la-da, da-da-la-da. Well, that's one of the songs that I heard Shadow Wilson play with Monk and Train at the Five Spot that I liked a lot. And then when I went with him in the Five Spot, him, Monk, I still thought of what I heard Shadow playing. So I did something that was probably related to that, maybe. Like, da 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 da
da da da da da da da da da. John Coltrane with Monk playing Epistrophe. You're listening to a tribute to Thelonious Monk on Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. Monk's engagement at the Five Spot won him a new following and reputation. The hallmark of a good composer is the adaptability of his or her music to different-sized groups. Monk's growth was helped by performances with larger and larger ensembles. In March 1959, Monk's newfound respect led to this program at New York's Town Hall with Monk's quartet and what was advertised as a 10-piece orchestra. The music was arranged by Hal Overton. Here's Monk at Town Hall playing Little Rudy Tootie.
This music is a wonderful world in itself, and we don't need comparisons to Schoenberg or Bartok for validity.
Composer and pianist Anthony Davis. His compositions, including an opera based on the life of Malcolm X, have received critical acclaim. Davis says Thelonious Monk's influence has been crucial.
I bought the Live at Town Hall record, the Hall Overton arrangements, and Hall was at Yale, I guess just before I got to Yale. And I think he did a wonderful job with the orchestration, because it's really Monk's piano playing come to life. You know, how he orchestrates it, you know, using the horn, French horn, and the baritone, saxophone, et cetera, to really assimilate in a way that kind of orchestration of Monk's kind of altered stride piano playing. So I really admire what he did in his arrangement of Monk's music.
In the 1960s, Thelonious Monk continued recording. Now for Columbia, his biggest label and most generous contract. By 1964, he was one of only four jazz musicians to grace the cover of Time magazine. But fame and notoriety didn't change Monk much. Again, Thelonious Monk speaking with Val Wilmer from an interview in the early 1960s.
Well, I've got a wife and two kids. Anything to take care of, so I have to make some money and see that they eat and sleep, and me too.
Yeah. And you don't care what happens around the corner?
It's not my business what's happening with his family. I have to take care of my family, but I help a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
and I have.
By the end of the 1960s, Monk toured Europe with an octet, and his compositional legacy, over 80 works, was almost complete. 6 years before his death, Thelonious Monk ceased playing music altogether. No one knows why he stopped. Most of those final years were spent alone in New Jersey, at the home of the Baroness de Koenigswerter. She gave Monk an entire upper floor of her home in which to play, sleep, or just think. No more than a few steps away from his bed was a piano. Thelonious Sphere Monk died of a stroke in Inglewood Hospital on February 17th, 1982. Max Roach.
It came as a shock to me when Monk finally passed. Like everyone else, though, it's always a shock, you know. But his spirit and his image and his music is just pervasive. It's all over the place. But, you know, some people you you know personally and that you grew up with and you spend time sharing studios and joints and concert halls with, you know, you just, you think that they're never, it's never going to end, you know, and so it goes.
Pianist Jerry Allen.
He had resistance from many different angles, and yet he persevered and became more himself all the time. And that, for me, is a great inspiration and a great beacon for all of us to look toward, to have the courage to be oneself, I think is probably the major challenge in this music. And life.
In February 1993, Thelonious Fia Monk's contributions won a posthumous Grammy Award for Lifetime Achievement. More than 20 years before his death, Monk provided perhaps his best epitaph when he told writer Grover Sales, "For years they were telling me to play commercial, be commercial. I'm not commercial. I say, play your own way. You play what you want and let the public pick up on what you were doing, even if it takes 15, 20 years." Chick Corea.
I guess Round Midnight became Monk's most well-known tune. I think Miles's renditions helped make it that way. It is a gorgeous piece and has become, for a jazz musician, sort of like playing the blues almost, like so familiar, you know.
Did you ever think that you'd, you know, become a world-famous jazz pianist?
Well, that's what I was aiming at.
Our tribute to Thelonious Monk was written and produced by Walter Ray Watson, Jr. Co-producer, Rolando Arrieta. Post-production engineer, Preston Brown. With production help from Madeline Smith. Special thanks to Eugene Holly. Monk biographer, Peter Keat News. And NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith, executive producers Murray Horwitz and Mary Beth Kirshner. To email us or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Support for this program comes from a major grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, connecting artists and communities through jazz. Additional support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Program Fund, National Public Radio member stations, NPR, and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.